I'd like to call to order the Higher Ed Committee Policy and Finance. Today is March the 16th, and we have already our testifiers at the testifier stand. Do we have a quorum? Representative Isaacson, would you like to move the approval of the minutes?
So moved, Representative Christensen. Thank you.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Okay. Welcome back, everybody, from a very long evening. And we're going to start with Minnesota Private College Council overview. So if you could state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Sirkvenik. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. I want to thank you for the invitation to testify before the committee today. And I also want to take a minute to thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nornes, and the committee members who took time this fall to visit a number of our campuses. We really enjoy the opportunity to have you on campus. We know many of you are busy and have other jobs, and it's not easy to do that, but we're grateful that some of you were able to take the time to do that. With me today are three presidents from our colleges: Paul Pribino from Augsburg, Bill Kraft from Concordia College, and Larry Goodwin from the College of St. Scholastica. Before you hear from the presidents, I'd like to give you a brief overview about the role and collective impact of the 17 colleges and universities that comprise the Minnesota Private College Council. Although each college has its own unique history and mission, and each has its own special character and educational focus, they are all nonprofit institutions and all provide an education that's basically liberal arts in character. And as the colleges like to remind me, they are independent institutions. Each one functions under the governance of its own board of trustees and not as the part of or under the control of any larger system. Our schools play a significant role in providing higher education opportunities for Minnesota students and in contributing to the human capital and workforce development in our state. Of our 58,000 students, about 42,000 are undergrads, and a little under 42,000, about 41,000 are undergrads, and about 17,000 are graduate students. About 70% of our undergraduates are Minnesotans. The remainder are national and international students who are attracted to the opportunities our colleges offer. We attract about 12,900 four-year students from other states, which is actually more than either the Minscu or the U of M system. That's especially important considering that Minnesota is a net exporter of high school graduates to colleges outside of Minnesota. We think attracting some non-Minnesota students here is a benefit for the state. When it comes to graduates, we produce about 30% of the four-year degrees granted annually in Minnesota, including a significant share of degrees in the fields of chemistry, physics, biology, math, business, foreign languages, and healthcare, as well as about 42% of all the master's degrees granted in the state. In fact, although each of our colleges are relatively small in size, taken together, they have a large-scale collective impact in our state in terms of the graduates we produce. Today, we know there are at least 228,000 private college alums living and working in Minnesota. I want to say a little bit about the students we serve. The students we serve reflect Minnesota, and this slide highlights a few facts to know about our students. I won't mention them all, but let me just say that 25% of our students come from families with incomes under $40,000. And another 25% come from families with incomes between $40,000 and $80,000. In fact, the median family income at our colleges is about $78,000, just a little lower than the median family income at the University of Minnesota. 20% of our students are students of color. And six of our colleges offer evening, weekend, and online degree completion programs for working adults. Those programs account for 7% of our total enrollment. And for the six schools that do that kind of education, that those students account for 19% of their enrollment. The model of our undergraduate education is at our colleges is student-focused. The small sizes and the residential character of our campuses create a positive learning environment for our students. We have great faculty-to-student ratios and small class sizes, which intentionally foster a high degree of interaction and engagement between students and their professors. When students are engaged in the classroom experience and in the campus life of a college community, they have improved learning outcomes and higher on-time graduation rates. And we deeply value experiential learning and global study. 90% of our alumni tell us that they participated in internships, faculty-supervised research projects, or study abroad opportunities while in college. Experiential learning and study abroad opportunities provide students with educational experiences outside the traditional classroom, experiences that employers find highly valuable. Our student-centered approach to education leads to good outcomes for the students we serve. Our four-year graduation rate of 66% is not only the highest compared to public and private systems in the Midwest, but it ranks third in the nation for private colleges on a state-by-state basis. Students of color also have high graduation rates at our college. Our 52% four-year graduation rate is significantly above the rate for private colleges nationally, which is 44%. Overall, when looking at students who start and complete a degree at our institutions, 87% of those graduates complete their degree within 4 years. Graduating on time is critical to holding down the cost of college and the level of student borrowing. A report by Complete College America suggested that students who take 6 years to graduate can have debt levels as much as 70% higher than their peers who graduate on time. And then I just want to mention that our graduates are doing well in the workforce. A recent release of data by Deed and Ohi showed that in the fourth year after graduation, our students are earning on average $49,000 a year. But postgraduate earnings aren't the only measure of success in college. About 20% of our graduates go on from college immediately to advanced study in graduate and professional degree programs. I want to say a little bit about affordability. At our colleges, 90% of our students receive financial aid that does not have to be paid back. The average first-time, full-time student receives over $19,500 in grants and scholarships. This is possible in significant part because our colleges annually award more than $500 million in institutionally provided scholarships, grants, and tuition discounts. This compares to $43 million in state grants received by our students and $54 million in Pell Grants and other federal grant aid available to students at our college. The financial aid provided by our colleges, combined with the state grants and federal Pell Grants, means that the average net tuition is the price students actually pay, is less than half the published price on average. As you can see in this chart, most importantly, our colleges are striving to control costs for families. As this graph shows, our average net price for freshmen has not increased faster than CPI inflation for the last 10 years. In fact, on an inflation-adjusted basis, average net tuition at our institutions is lower today than it was in 2007 and 2008. To put it another way, in the 5 years since the Great Recession of 2008, our inflation-adjusted net tuition has been lower every year than it was in any of the 5 years preceding the recession. As you know, our schools do not receive state appropriations for operating support or capital funding. Only a small share of the state higher education budget, about 3%, benefits our students who are eligible to receive need-based financial aid through the Minnesota State Grant Program, a program that supports students at both public and private institutions. 24% of our students receive a state grant. On behalf of those students, I want to thank you. Our students and our colleges are grateful for the support provided by legislators on a bipartisan basis for the grant program. Studies show that there are great income and race-based disparities in education in our society. A recent Pell Institute study reported that 77% of students from high-income families obtain a four-year degree by age 24, but only 9% of students from low-income families. obtain a four-year degree by age 24. The state grant helps reduce those disparities. And the state grant can and does make a big difference for students with the greatest need. State grants allow students to attend the college that fits them best and serves them best. It helps students find a reasonable balance between work and study. It helps students graduate on time, and it reduces the need for excessive borrowing. So we appreciate the support the legislature has given to the state grant program. And if there is a supplemental spending bill and if higher education is a part of that bill, we hope that you will invest directly in students again with additional funding for the state grant program. We've sent a letter to Chair Nornes and Chair Bonhoff with a specific suggestion. We tried to make it reasonable in light of the budget realities, and we hope that'll become part of the consideration if there's a supplemental bill. And I want to stop there and let you hear from my college presidents.
Thank you, Mr. Serkvenik. Thank you for your testimony today. Please state your name for the please state your name for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Pribanow, the president of Augsburg College. It's my great pleasure to be here with you and to have a chance to share a few thoughts about Augsburg and the ways in which the state grant program has a direct impact on our students in a daily way. Before I begin, though, I think I would be remiss if I didn't start here with a reminder that this week we're mourning the loss of a great Augie, a graduate of Augsburg College from 1959, Martin Sable, who served, of course, as Speaker of this House for 5 or 6 years in the 70s and then went on to serve us all in Washington. We are so proud of that legacy and so much as we share in the mourning with his family, we also make a commitment to continuing the legacy that I know all of us care about here in Minnesota, and that is a commitment to civic agency, to engagement, to helping our students think about the roles they play as citizens in the world. So we will all gather to celebrate his life on Saturday morning at Central Lutheran Church in Minneapolis. Augsburg is perhaps a distinctive place within the context of the private sector in that we are located right in the heart of the city. As you know, we're in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood, perhaps the most diverse zip code between Chicago and Los Angeles, and that location has made a great deal of difference. We've been in that neighborhood for almost 150 years. And what it's done over the past decade or so is it's allowed us to become a place that really mirrors the diversity of our cities, especially of the Twin Cities here. And so at this point, Augsburg is the second most diverse four-year college in Minnesota, just after a metro state, where about 40% of our entering classes over the last 7 or 8 years have been students of color. And we take that quite seriously. It's created a community of diversity and inclusion that is very powerful, both in the classroom as well as in the residence halls, around campus and out in the world. And we believe that diversity is actually helping us to prepare the pipeline of workforce that we're going to need in this state. And we feel like that's a particular role that we can play because of our location in the city. As I mentioned, we have about almost 3,500 students at Augsburg in two different campuses. We're in Minneapolis, of course, but we are also in Rochester, where we've had a campus for the last 17 years. We're proud of that. There are about 1,000 Augsburg graduates in the Rochester area who graduated from one of our programs there, both undergraduate and graduate. We have 50 majors. We have 9 masters. We have a doctoral program in nursing, and so have really become a small regional university. We're also very proud that we had the state's first physician assistant, master's and physician assistant studies program that was started back in 1997 and has now become such an important part of the healthcare model at many of our hospitals and healthcare systems here in Minnesota and around the country. Our students do represent our community. So over 40% of our students are first-generation students. More than 43% of our students receive the Minnesota State Grant. So we are certainly a testament, as Mr. Serkvenik has mentioned, to the impact of that program on students. So their ability as Minnesota residents to receive that grant in combination with the Pell Grants from the federal government and the institutional aid that we provide allows us to create access to college and make it affordable so that they can get their degrees in 4 years and be out into the workforce, and we couldn't be more grateful for that. That is more than $3 million a year for us of aid that comes directly from that program for our students. 100% of our students at Augsburg complete what we call experiential opportunities, so they take advantage of being here in the city, and they're doing internships or research projects or studying away either domestically or abroad. More than 80% of our students stay here in Minnesota once they graduate, and that's a very important part of, I think, the legacy we have as a college here in the Twin Cities. I want to talk about the four very specific things about Augsburg that I think will be of interest to you. First is how we are actually trying to create that pathway from Augsburg for a more diverse workforce. So we are a very strong partner of this program called College Possible, formerly called Admission Possible, that was started here in the 20 cities. And we have about 150 of our students currently are actually alums of that program. So they were identified in high school, in one of the area high schools here in the Twin Cities, and were educated, were equipped to come to college. They then come onto our campus and are supported by much of our student support services to help them be successful in college. So that's been one of the ways that we've really diversified our student body. We also have a very strong relationship with Travelers Edge, the Travelers Insurance Company here. We're one of the campuses that where they come in and recruit students from our campus, provide financial support to them for scholarships, but also give them mentoring and internship possibilities that create, a pipeline of those students into the workforce. We received $500,000 this past year from the Great Lakes Career Ready Grant Program, which is providing paid internships for low-income students. So another way that we can help a student to afford college so that they have to go off and do that internship, but they also have a chance to be paid for that. And that's important in particular when they're working perhaps in small businesses that couldn't afford to do that internship. So we're a leg up there. And we're also the recipient of a federal program, McNair Scholars Program, that provides support for students who are on their way to graduate or professional school, and particularly serves underrepresented students. So many programs that we have that are really around that pathway, if you will, to a more diverse workforce. One of the programs that we're most proud of is something we're calling the Augie Plan. We launched this last May with the Minneapolis Community and Technical College, and it's a partnership that is now unfolding with some of our other MCTC or other Minsky institutions, St. Paul College, Normandale, Inver Hills, and we think that by 2017 we'll have five of these agreements. And what it's doing is it's a deep partnership between the community college and Augsburg, where we reach back into high schools and even sometimes into middle school to try to create a pathway for a student to imagine going to college. And they actually enter MCTC or the community college almost with a sense of being a part of two institutions. So they take their courses at MCTC, but they receive support from faculty and staff at Augsburg even while they're at MCTC. We are very dedicated to making this a much more predictable pathway to success in college, both at the community college as well as at Augsburg, and then ultimately it leads them out into the workforce in a much more direct way. And we are now have been able to keep the cost of that program overall for those students to $15,000 for the entire 4 years. And so a very powerful response from a private college to some of the concerns about costs that is really the result of a public-private partnership that we're developing with the Minsky institutions here in the Twin Cities area. We're very proud of that. We think it's going to expand perhaps even beyond those five agreements, and we'll really create that, again, that pipeline that both is about access, managing costs, but then is also about making sure those students get into the workforce in a direct way. Another program that I want to lift up is our Step Up program. I think many of you are aware of this program. It's the largest residential collegiate recovery program in the United States. It was started back in 1997. There are nearly 100 students currently in that program. We house them in a separate residence hall. We support them. Otherwise, we mainstream them into the college, into the classroom, into all the student activities. We are very proud that it's a model. It's now being replicated by our graduates around the country and other institutions. It has a 95% plus abstinence rate for students, a very high GPA, and it's been named by the White House Office of Drug Control and Policy as the gold standard for collegiate recovery, and is lifted up as actually one of the planks of their strategy for responding to overcoming the stigma of addiction. We're very proud that the U.S. Director of National Drug Control Policy, Michael Botticelli, is actually coming to Augsburg at the end of April to give our commencement address in honor of this program. So another way that we're responding to some of the needs of our students in a way that we hope allows them to get that college education and be on their way to the good work that they will do in the world. Also very proud of the fact that we have become a Yellow Ribbon military-friendly school. We have over more than 130 active military veterans and ROTC enrollees and spouses on campus.
Can I interrupt for just a moment? Did one of the pages go find somebody in the technical part of this building? Did they? I
believe it's the
remote. It's the what?
I'm going to move the remote down below.
Oh, and see if that may be it, although I've heard it, I think, before. But that, yeah. Well, it seems to have gone away now. So
very good.
Okay, proceed.
So the
yellow ribbon funding that we receive helps us to support those veterans. The veterans, the VA has actually put a staff person on campus to help support our veteran students. And we had wonderful support from U.S. Bank just last year that allowed us to actually create a separate lounge for those students. And you see the quote there from one of our graduate students who's a vet that came back. And it's that reaching out to them, welcoming them when they come back from their tours of service, and being able to support them again and to bring with all the skills that they have to prepare them to go into the workforce. One of the proudest moments for me each fall is at our home football games this past year. Each of those games, the three members of the football team who were veterans presented the colors at the beginning of every game, and it was a wonderful chance for us to announce to the entire gathering the tours of service that each of them had provided before they came back to go to college and then to play football, which was also a wonderful thing. So we believe deeply that inclusion matters in the 21st century workforce, so we're working on many fronts in that regard. For the last 2 years, we've been named one of the top five colleges in the country on the President's Interfaith and Community Service Challenge, which is one of the things that we're doing in our neighborhood in particular, where our neighbors almost are all Muslim, and that has attracted a good number of Muslim students, but also students from other traditions to our campus, so we're becoming almost a laboratory, if you will, for interfaith living. And we think that what we're doing is very deliberate efforts to build diversity, inclusion, competency among our staff and faculty on campus. So some really significant programs that we have developed, which are actually becoming a model. We're taking that the diversity inclusion certificate program and actually taking it to Rochester, and the Chamber of Commerce in Rochester is going to be offering our certificate program to area businesses. So a place where what we've learned in our experience can actually be of service to the broader state. So I would just end by pointing to a project we're very, very proud of that will have an impact on the economy in Minneapolis. This is the Hagfors Center for Science, Business, and Religion, a major new academic building on our campus, 135,000 square feet that we will open in this January of 2018. We'll break ground later this spring. It is about an $80 million capital project that, once the stadium is done, may be the largest capital project happening in the city of Minneapolis. So we're very proud that that will make a real difference on our campus. It will draw lots of folks from our neighborhood kind of into campus and give them a chance to benefit from our education, but also will give back in some real economic impact sorts of ways. So this is our vision statement for Augsburg. We claim that in 2019 we will be a new kind of student-centered urban university, small to our students and big for the world. And I think, as Mr. Cigmenic has mentioned, that is really something that we think stands for the work of our private colleges across this sector. It's a wonderful state for education generally, for higher education certainly, and for private higher education. And we're very proud to be a partner with our 16 sister colleges and universities that that are all small to their students and big for the world. So I thank you for your time and attention, and I'll pass it along to my colleague from Concordia.
Yeah, before we do that, I think we talked about a gentleman by the name of Gabrielson.
Yes.
When he visited the campus.
Right.
So when you rename a building, the Gabrielson site or whatever, let me know.
Okay, I promise you.
He was a friend of mine.
First on my list.
From my hometown. And so is his brother. Anyway, sorry I interrupted, but go ahead and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is William Kraft, and I'm the president of Concordia College in the border town of Moorhead, Minnesota.
Welcome.
And with my colleagues, I am thankful to you and all the members of the committee for the chance to talk today about the work of our private colleges in Minnesota for the individual benefit of our students and for the public good of our state. I want to talk in particular about integrity and innovation in the choices that we make at Concordia College for the sake of our students and the communities that they will serve. Entering now our 125th year, Concordia is a global liberal arts college of the church rooted in Lutheran values. Central to those values is the freedom to search for truth and the freedom to turn outward from self to the good of one's neighbor. Freedom for learning and freedom for service. Integrity requires that we sustain those values as we seek, in the words of our mission, to influence the affairs of the world. So let me speak of service first. The goal of our curriculum is for students to become responsibly engaged in the world. Undergraduates at the college give themselves not only to a wide range of service for nonprofits and churches in our region, but also to service-oriented research and internships that shape both their undergraduate lives and subsequent careers. After college, Carvers devote themselves to the public good in manifold ways, including appointed and elected office. I think of Chief Judge John Thunheim, who serves as our board chair, and I'm glad to name Representatives Dan Fabian, Sandra Harrickson, Deb Keel, all Concordia students, and Senator Kent Eakin, who is a Concordia College graduate. Beyond these roles, the life of service to neighbor can be found in the 25% of each Concordia graduating class who become teachers, the 15 to 20% of each class who go into healthcare, and in our church body, the 14% of all EOCA pastors who are Concordia grads. Every year, 40% of Concordia grads stay in the state of Minnesota to work and to serve, with an additional 25% just across the Red River. We take service seriously as an institution as well, most fundamentally in a commitment to access and affordability. 99% of Concordia students receive financial aid from the college. One in four of our students receives a Pell Grant. I am proud and grateful to say to you this afternoon that 4 in 10 of our Minnesota students received the Minnesota State Grant, which is critical not only to their resources, but critical to our ability to compete on the border with a large state university in Fargo that has been offering full tuition rides for highly qualified high school grads. I'm equally proud to tell you that on average, Concordia students pay less than half of our published tuition price. And we keep costs down as well by ensuring that more than 90% of the students who come to Concordia and stay graduate in 4 years or fewer. In fact, starting next year, we guarantee that our students will graduate in 4 years or fewer. If they don't, and if they have remained in good academic standing, we will provide the courses that they need free of charge. We also keep down costs through the Tri-College University, which I know some of you know about. This allows our students at no extra cost to take courses across the street at MSUM, Representative Lean's alma mater, and at NDSU. And we are now constructing pathways agreements with community college partners, pathways that create both a straight road for transfer and strong aid for transfers as they transition to Concordia. Our recent Up to You signing ceremony with M State is a bright example of that commitment. Let me turn now to learning. The wide range of competitors coupled with flat family incomes post-recession and with the current low and first-time degree-seeking students in our state means that every college, including long-established institutions like Concordia, must make disciplined choices. Disciplined choices that secure program excellence and that meet or anticipate new market needs. Concordia has long been known for its programs in biology, music, and education, for its remarkable med school and law school placement rates. 88% of our students who apply to med school or law school are accepted. For its commitment to international study, our students study internationally at 5 times the national average. And more recently, for its Offutt School of Business, an enterprise that is dedicated to creating ethical, global-ready business leaders. These forms of excellence will be sustained, as will the striking success of our grads. We survey our graduates 6 months after they finish. 98% of them, they tell us, 98% are in jobs, in graduate school, or in full-time volunteer activities. Committed to integrity, then, we have kept faith with our mission of learning and service, sustaining established forms of academic excellence and of readiness to enable students to afford, attend, and graduate from Concordia on time in 4 years. We have at the same time made decisions about the optimal size of our undergraduate program and aligned programs and staff accordingly. The story of right sizing can attract some attention. But of equal or greater significance is the story of innovation in new learning for our students. And I want to turn to this in the latter part of my remarks. Innovation that is in accord with mission and market alike. So here, in brief, is an account of that innovation. In the last year alone at Concordia, new majors in neuroscience and in finance in a program supported by the Mellon Foundation to infuse digital skills into the studies of the humanities and the fine arts. A new program in development now among our mathematics and Offutt School faculty in computational and data science. A new graduation requirement that every Concordia student must engage in extended projects that apply the discoveries of the liberal arts to the unscripted challenges of work in community. We call these PEAK experiences. And the Concordia Career Initiative, which is a four-year sequence of reflection and real-world work for every student to prepare for jobs or graduate school. This commitment guides every student to explore, to plan for, to test, and to find a place in the job market or grad school. And a complete renovation now underway of our science facilities on time and on budget, thanks to skilled design, cost discipline, and wonderful fundraising. So, integrity in our learning and service mission, innovation to meet the needs of today's students and tomorrow's community leaders, these define our work for the benefit of our students and for the good of our state. Thank you. In closing, let me thank you for your service and particularly for your devotion to higher education. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Kraft, right? Before you move away from the microphone, I was just going to suggest one thing. You listed some graduates. Senator Cal Larson would like to be on that list. So I'll just make him feel good. He's a former state senator, longtime Cobber, and just in case the word gets out that he wasn't on the list. So his grandson works in this building, so that's why I'm saying it could happen. So
thank you for saving me.
Okay, you're welcome. All right. Thank you again for your testimony. And now, you're lucky you're not in Duluth today.
I was in Duluth.
Were you? Weather up there is just like winter, huh?
It's a mess.
Yeah. Go ahead. Introduce yourself and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Larry Goodwin, president of the College of St. Scholastica up in Duluth. I thought I would share a handful of fast facts about the college and then talk about two issues that we're working with up at the school. So some fast facts. We're a Catholic Benedictine school founded in 1912, actually by a group of Benedictine sisters who came from St. Cloud up to Duluth to help the bishop build the diocese. Our current enrollment is about 4,360 students, of whom 1,850 are traditional undergraduates, and the other 2,510 are non-traditional students, so-called, in master's programs, in accelerated learning programs at one of our extended campuses. We do this in Duluth, but also down here in St. Paul, and also in St. Cloud. We are embedded at Central Lakes Community College in Brainerd, have been since the 80s, and more recently at Inverhills College here, where a student can earn a two-year degree, stay in place, and we can bring them a four-year degree, usually in business or social work. While we offer most undergraduate programs except engineering, our long suit is in healthcare, reflecting the fact that the sisters who came to Duluth, first of all, took over St. Mary's Hospital before they founded the college. And today, 70% of our students are majoring in nursing or in one of the health professions, such as occupational therapy or physical therapy, electronic records, and several others, and also majors in the hard sciences. These are usually people who are pre-something, pre-med, pre-ophthalmology, so on. We're also a yellow ribbon school and serve over 100 veterans and National Guard members. And we were so impressed by Paul's Step Up program for recovering for students who are recovering from addiction that we started one a few years ago called the CLEAN program, and now we serve 41 students in that program, some of them from neighboring institutions like the University of Minnesota Duluth. 40% of our students are first generation. 30% come from family incomes of $50,000 or less. Last year, 850 of our students received the state grant program. The average award was about $4,000. I want to thank you for your support of the program. It makes a tremendous difference for students. We graduate our students at about 55% in 4 years. We place them at 97% that are employed or in graduate school within 6 months of graduation. The average starting salary of our graduates is $47,500. Having said all that, our mission is much more than workforce preparation. It also includes helping students develop a moral compass, helping them develop a life philosophy, and helping them become productive citizens of our democracy. Part of the higher purpose of higher education that I think we all share is not only getting students ready for the world of work, but getting them ready to be members of our society and deal with issues like terrorism, climate change, and race. And we believe strongly that higher education ought to be helping solve these problems. So the two issues that I want to talk about, the first one is that we are working to reconceive academic excellence in terms of diversity and inclusivity rather than simply the best and the brightest. Of course, it's true that we want to attract top-tier students to our school, but we also want to be a place where students from different backgrounds learn to excel. For many people, excellence is by definition an exclusionary term, and indeed, one guaranteed way to raise your profile in U.S. News rankings is to turn away more and more students. You're not good enough for us. Inclusive excellence turns that definition upside down. I very much like the way Arizona State University puts it. They say, we define excellence not by who we exclude, but by who we include and how well they succeed. Inclusive excellence means that all students, including historically disadvantaged students, are accepted into colleges and universities of their choice at comparable rates, that they enroll at comparable rates in things like honors programs and study abroad programs, and that they persist and graduate at comparable rates, regardless of income level, skin color, or ethnic background. Inclusive excellence does not mean that everybody deserves an A. Rather, it means that college success rates should reflect differences in ability or effort, not differences in income, race, or ethnicity. Inclusive excellence thus refers to equality of access and equality of opportunity for all students, and that's the ideal. The reality, however, is that, as one report puts it, despite years of increasing diversity in overall post-secondary enrollment, educational opportunity in the United States and the economic and social benefits it affords remain markedly stratified along racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic lines. For instance, an average student from the upper income quartile has a far greater chance of college success than an exceptional student from the lowest quartile. And at St. Scholastica, the graduation rates for students of color lag those of other students. So it's an issue we're dealing with. In addition to a moral problem, this situation represents an economic threat to our state and our country. By 2027, which is 11 years, half of the students in U.S. high schools will be students of color. So if we cannot enroll these students in college and educate them successfully, then our future as a diverse democracy and a productive economy is in jeopardy. This is an issue that we're wrestling with. The second issue is how to make college more affordable. If higher education is really essential for democracy, then it must itself be democratic, and that means financially accessible. Like my counterparts here at St. Scholastica, we post a tuition sticker price, and then we offer institutional scholarships, which are mostly discounted tuition, to 98% of our traditional students. The average award is $17,000. So we post a price of $34,000, and we essentially discount it, on average, 50% for students. That's one way we work to keep it affordable. We've also worked hard over the past several years, as Bill has been and Paul, but Bill referred to it, to tighten our operations by taking things out of the budget. We've stripped out about $4 million on our $70 million budget. My own opinion, however, is that we cannot solve the affordability problem just through incremental adjustments to the status quo or endless rounds of budget reductions. Something bolder is required. I can use an example. A Lexus is a superb car, and most people would love to own one and drive one, but not everybody can afford a Lexus. So Toyota makes less expensive options, including the humble Corolla. A Corolla is not a Lexus, but it is a Toyota. And I think that we need to build an educational Corolla. We need to build a St. Scholastica Corolla. We need a new model. I don't have it all figured out, but I believe the clues are all around us, and they include things like competency-based and problem-based learning, so that we would charge students not for how long their seats are in the seats, but for their demonstrated competencies. And if somebody can get to a competency in half the time it takes me, I say let's let them keep moving. Another ingredient would be partnerships with business and industry and with other educational institutions. Case in point, I went to talk to the new CEO of Essentia Health in Duluth, asking for support to invest in a nursing skills lab on our campus. And here's what he said. I want to help you with that skills lab, but what about if we think about it differently? What about if I build it down here at the hospital, in exchange for which I get your senior nursing students for half of their senior year to partner up with my staff nurses so that by the time they graduate, they're practice ready? This is a really interesting idea. This is a CEO offering to put skin in the game in exchange for partnership with his staff nurses, and I think it's a very appealing offer. And a third ingredient would be the shrewd use of technology to shift the faculty role more towards coaching and mentoring. I think if I give a really good lecture on topic X, why don't we videotape it or digitize it, or better yet, why don't we get the best one in the country and assign it to students for homework, and then have students come to class or use their class time with me for something quite different, which would be application or problem solving. Schools that are experimenting with this, I think, are finding that it may be possible to offload some of what we do to technology, and therefore to reduce our workforce, and therefore to lessen the cost to students. So those are a couple things we're wrestling with. As a private college, we're trying to broaden our notion of academic excellence, and we're trying to innovate to make college more affordable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we do have a question, right? Representative Grunhagen.
I have 10 questions.
No, you don't.
Hey, thank you for your presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Goodwin, I just caught one thing that you said in your presentation, and there were a lot of good points, but you talked about reducing or eliminating seat time. And that, I was on the school board for an extended period of time. And that's the Carnegie unit to me. And the last time I saw a reform on the Carnegie unit was called the Profile of Learning, and the state of Minnesota under Arnie Carlson wasted about $1 billion, okay, which I never did support that boondoggle experiment. But
that was in K through 12, right?
Yeah, that was K through 12, I know.
Different application.
But when you talk, and again, I understand projects, and but I do think academically a certain amount of seat time is necessary under the Carnegie unit. Or what were you, I guess, just wanted to vet out that comment a little bit more, because I'd hate to have the profile of learning move into the higher ed, to tell you the truth.
President Goodwin there.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for the comment. As a matter of fact, about 1,000 of our students are in online programming, so and it's, you know, they can get federal support for those programs. So the notion of seat time has already been abandoned in some programs. And if you ask, well, what do you substitute for it? What you substitute is a demonstration of certain level of competency. So, you know, people often say we don't ask the faculty member how long they sat in front of the computer to write the book. We just say, is it a good book? And I believe if we think carefully about outcomes and what we're trying to achieve, that we could use a combination of seat time, online learning, but most especially demonstrated competencies to achieve.
Another question? Representative Goodwin.
Just a follow-up comment.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Goodwin. No, I'm not against technology and you know, doing online learning. But I do question moving to a project-based educational system, which is what the profile of learning, and it wanted to diminish the seat time aspect of education. So that, I just want a little clarification on that. So thank you.
I know, I don't know if there's any other questions, but I just want to say all three of the presentations, and I didn't get here for the entire first, and I apologize for that, but you know, what you're doing is amazing and very important to the state, to our students, and you all have your little niche and doing it well. So appreciate you being here to testify. And if we have no other questions, oh, we do have one, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for Mr. Cernik-Bennick. I know, I feel like I asked you this last year, and so I apologize, but just from my own memory, taking a look back at the graph you have on affordability here, it looks like we have some dips in the tuition. It looks like 2009, 2010, a little bit 2012, 13. Can you just explain a little bit about what went into some of those reduced tuition rates?
Yeah. Well, I do want to invite my presidents to also respond, but the committee needs to understand.
I just need your name.
Oh, I know Paul Cernik-Bennick again, yeah. President of the Private College Council. So, Mr. Chair and Representative Lean, this line represents an aggregate of what's happening at all 17 of our institutions. They're each in the marketplace making their own judgments about an appropriate price and value that they provide students, the ability to provide financial aid, and meeting the needs of their students in terms of price. I think one way to understand what happens at our colleges is our colleges look at the students they're serving and do the best they can to make the education they're offering affordable for the families at a wide range of incomes. And so they're adjusting their price and financial aid package each year to meet the realities that are out there in the marketplace. And that dip in 2008-09 reflects in part what was happening in the economy at that time. Families were really struggling. And so that's, I think, what you're seeing in here. And then the reason I included this chart for the committee was I wanted you to get a glimpse that over time the price students actually pay is not rising as fast as it was a decade or two ago. And that's a story that isn't sinking in yet publicly, but it's the reality today in higher education, in my view. And I don't know if anyone else wants to add to that.
I think you've done well. Yeah, we need to wrap it up so we can move on to the next part, but if you want to follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up comment. I was just going to say, you know, it looks to me like you're getting a handle on tuition a little better than some of the public schools. I know we've seen slides where the U of M going up an average of 5.5% each year, so I guess I just wanted to get a little insight on what your trick is, but thank you. It sounds like I should be asking the individual colleges that question, so thank you.
And thank you for being here and testifying today. We've talked for a lot longer, but we have another presentation from Bethel University coming up, and also Bill has to be also heard today, so thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay, representatives from Bethel, whoever is kind of the lead spokesperson. I know we have a number of individuals and students from there. While they're getting organized, I want to thank everyone for being here yesterday for our long, long hearing and sticking with us as long as you could. Some of you were able to see yourself on TV last night. We made the news, that's what I'm telling you. Not all committees can say that. And it was good. You can say that too. So it was good.
I don't know. I don't want to.
I don't want to see it. I don't want to see that.
I saw it on a couple channels. Which one? I saw it again this morning. You've seen the agenda, members. It's Bethel and their BUILD program is what we're going to be talking about here, and I've seen it firsthand, and I think you'll be interested and amazed by it. So, how's that for an introduction?
Lovely.
Good. Are we about set? Okay. Well, maybe we can start talking while that's warming up. Who's going to actually start? Okay, go ahead and introduce yourself then and proceed.
Deb Harless, Provost of Bethel University, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. On behalf of Bethel University President Jay Barnes, I want to thank you for your consideration of the bill that would allow students who are enrolled in programs like Bethel University's...
It's working.
...like Bethel University's Inclusive Learning and Development Program, or what we affectionately call BUILD, it would allow those students to have access to the Minnesota State Grant. We're grateful for the opportunity to be here with you today and to provide information on our BUILD program and the students it serves. The BUILD program at Bethel is a residential post-secondary educational experience for students with intellectual disabilities. Bethel's commitment to this program comes directly out of our core values as learners and reconcilers and world changers. Our BUILD program is also anchored in our significant experience in the field of special education, with more than 20 years of providing graduate programs for special ed teachers. Through this program, we're able to provide life-changing educational opportunities to enhance students' independent living skills, as well as to prepare them for employment opportunities that match their interests. Today, you'll hear from Dawn Allen, our BUILD program director, as well as Rita, who's a student from Maplewood in our BUILD program, and Annika, a student from Eden Prairie, who's also in our BUILD program. And this is our inaugural year of the program.
All right, thank you. And just adjust the mic and then again, begin by identifying yourself for the record, please.
And I think we're still having technology issues. I'm going to have to restart, so I apologize. But yes, I want to tell you that my heart and mind is here, and we're hoping that my voice will also hold out. Okay. Get that good notes that we can tag team if we need to. But
we can hear you fine.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm Dawn Allen, director of the BUILD program, and got to figure out how to get this to start again. Excuse me. This is actually always a fun thing for the students. They often get to be tech support for me. It's not my skill set. All right, now here we go. So, to help give you a little bit of an introduction to the BUILD program, I do have a video. Our students are actually on spring break right now, so most of them are at home relaxing and enjoying the time off, and we did have two students who were willing to join us, but a lot of other students wanted to have a chance to share with you what they think is special or important about the BUILD program. So I do have that video that I'll start with, and then we'll give you a little bit more background information about the program. And please feel free to ask questions. We want to make sure that you get the information that you need about this program. And we're testing your patience also. So I think, was it you, Ben, who's from Morehead State University? I went there as well for my undergrad, so.
Go Dragons.
Yeah? Good history. And funny here about the tri-college thing and know, hey, I know what that means. All right, so I think our technology is working. Now I need to find it. That's not the video. Okay, sorry, with restarting, I've got to find it again. It is right here. You can see all the fun things we've been working on. Mm-hmm. Does anybody else's computer look like mine where you have to search through because you don't remember exactly where it is? I tried to add it to the desktop today and found out that there's too much there to add anything else. Here we go. So this is some of the students who are in the BUILD program this year sharing about what they think is important or special about the BUILD program.
I made I love to the program because it is fun to make friends, to have fun. I am planning to live on my own, get a job, and just settle down and have family.
Hi, my name is Monica, and my favorite part of the BUILD program is probably everything. Like, I love it all, and I don't know, I just love everything here at BUILD. It's like my favorite, and it's like such a dream come true, and I just love it all. When I'm done, like, here at BUILD, I have plenty on doing, like, a YWAM, it stands for Youth with a Mission, I'm in BUILD, Colorado, in my BTS, I'm out there, and I get more willing, I'm in Hawaii, my fourth year before, because, like, YWAM is, like, a secondary school, and, like, the best thing about BUILD for me is probably getting a college experience, and being able to be there at BUILD. I think just having, like, the internships and the classes, and kind of getting that real-life experience. What I plan to do after BUILD, when I graduate, is hopefully probably to work with special education or doing something to work with kids.
The BUILD program is good. It's nice for people that haven't had gone to college but want that college experience that's in the college that you don't get. And people that can afford it, they eventually get to get it with help.
My interest with the dance center.
What do you like about that?
I kind of pro crafts and care crafts and busy crafts and hair
fun. What do you think you'll do when you're done with it, when you graduate?
I might get a summer run for my
stuff. And what about living?
Living, my opinion.
The best thing I ever had to be in BUILD, and I like being with my friends, and I like having a job, like working for kids, like being a teacher, in preschools.
What do you think you're doing in the
BUILD program?
What else is good about the BUILD program?
Making new friends.
Mm-hmm. What do you think you'll do when you're done with the BUILD program?
Living on my own is being the BUILD.
Hi,
Very good. I believe that one student was the tour guide when I visited the campus, right?
She was. That was Maggie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She was sad that she couldn't be here with us today.
Well, the video was done well, good. Very well done.
Well, thank you for indulging me with that. I really believe in the power of people's stories, and so it's really great for you to hear directly from the students about what they appreciate about this program. And as we begin this conversation, I think another important thing for you to know really is this is not some crazy idea. It's really just about giving students an opportunity. So a quote that's from two women who wrote the book for these types of programs called Think College. They have a really great quote that really helps to explain that college doesn't give anything special to students with intellectual disabilities. Instead, it gives them something that everyone else who goes to college gets, and that's the opportunity to learn about yourself, to get a better job, and to grow up a little bit. And I think we would all agree that, you know, that was part of our college experience and how great it is to have an opportunity for students to do that. Another thing that I think is important to this conversation is some information about the history that tells us that really these opportunities have not been around for very long. It's not too long ago in our history that the only options for students with intellectual or developmental or any kind of significant disability was institutionalization or segregation. In the pictures that are here, you get a little glimpse into the separate segregated schools that were provided for what at the time was termed handicapped students, and that covered all ranges of disabilities. Another thing that was an option for a lot of people and what a lot of doctors recommended, even until pretty recent in our history, I can tell you I've talked to some parents of students in our program who were told by doctors that they should put their daughter into an institutionalization, that was the only hope for her. This same student is a student who was told that she would never read, and she's doing very well. In fact, I have permission from her to share. That was your tour guide who was told that she should be institutionalized and that she should be that her parents shouldn't expect that she would be able to read. And she has broken through those expectations, those low expectations, each time that she's been given an opportunity. Some of you may be familiar with Willowbrook State Hospital, or State School, excuse me. This we began to hear about back in 1965 by Robert Kennedy, who had visited the site. At that time, there were about 6,000 people living there in a place that was set up to house 6,000 or 4,000 people. He was really upset by what he saw. He called it a snake pit and called for reform. But unfortunately, it wasn't until about 7 years later when a name that I'm sure you all recognize, Geraldo Rivera, came to expose the school. He had gotten a key from a doctor who had been fired and was able to get in with cameras rolling to really expose what the conditions were when nobody was expecting a visit. That was in 1972. And that just helped to show that there really were not great opportunities, and it certainly wasn't anything that was inclusive for people with significant disabilities. So from there, we began to see that change began to happen. 3 years later, we had the passage of what was then called the Education for All Handicapped Children's Act in 1965. This is now called IDEA, or the Individual with Disability Education Act. And this was groundbreaking because for the first time, students weren't told that they couldn't come to a school in their school district. They were promised to have a free and appropriate public education. Another thing that had changed in this legislation was that there was now the creation of an individual education plan, and families were included in that process, so their rights were protected. No longer was it where a teacher would just decide that a student had a special need and they would be removed from the class. But parents and students were part of that process, and they were guaranteed access in the least restrictive environment. So no longer could it be, you have any kind of disability, you're going to be here and here. That's mine, sorry. From there, we began to see that this idea of inclusion began to spread. And so in 1990, we had the idea of inclusion spread to the community with the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. This act is what prohibits the discrimination against people with disabilities in employment, transportation, public accommodation, communications, and governmental activities. The bus that's pictured there just finished a tour of the nation celebrating 25 years since the passage of this act. And it's very fitting that there's a bus there because some of the big protests leading up to the need for this legislation was about the lack of access to transportation. So the other picture you see is from some of the protests where people in wheelchairs were not able to access public transportation. And so you can see how much of a difference this has made and how much it has pushed forward this idea that we really should be including
all individuals regardless of disability in all aspects of life. A couple more recent things that have changed to allow for these opportunities is the Olmsted Plan. Again, that was back in 1999, but it really wasn't until 2009 that the Civil Rights Division launched an aggressive effort to really enforce the Supreme Court's decision. And what that was is it was a ruling that required states to eliminate unnecessary segregation of persons with disabilities and to ensure that persons with disabilities receive services, again, in the most integrated setting appropriate to their needs. From there, in 2008, we also had the passage of the Higher Education Opportunity Act. This is a reauthorization of a previous act. But the new things that were in this act were several provisions related to students with intellectual disabilities. Part of this is they included the definition of what's called a comprehensive transition program. And also, they also funded some demonstration projects. Excuse me. The last thing that's listed there is also the development of the National Coordinating Center for TPSED, and what that stands for is Transition and Post-Secondary Education Programs for Students with Intellectual Disabilities. That's what the BUILD program is. And then I can tell you a little bit more about these types of programs. There's three different models that can be employed. We do actually currently have all three of these models in Minnesota, and I will share with you what they are. But what they are is there's an inclusive individual support. For that model, programs allow students with disabilities, significant disabilities, to join the college program if they're able to meet the admission guidelines. And then what they do is provide services and accommodations through disability resources and services, in addition, opt into additional mentor support because of students having some significant needs. The other type of program is mixed or hybrid. This is where you really see the combination of the transition focus and the post-secondary focus. So it's providing the skills and development that's needed in the areas of transition, which is helping students to transition into independent living in adulthood. Often includes work experience, job skills, things like laundry, cooking, all of these things that a lot of people take for granted or developed as part of college. Those things don't happen naturally for our students unless it's directly instructed. In addition, the mixed or hybrid programs also include access to post-secondary classes, classes that students want to take because they're interested in learning how to play badminton or how to become a better artist, not because it's required under any of the program pieces. And then the last piece is substantially separate. Again, that's a program that provides access, but unfortunately still is separate from what is typically occurring within the program or the setup. Regardless of the type of program, each of the programs do have the same benefits that they're working towards. It's that post-secondary experience. It's the work and opportunity to increase independent living skills. It's the work around increasing students' employability, as well as broadening those inclusive opportunities that I really believe are important. Currently, we have 256 programs nationwide. Six of those are here in Minnesota. And I've listed both what the programs are as well as what type of TPSED program they are. The Check and Connect programs are considered inclusive individual support. Students have to meet the traditional enrollment guidelines, but then get additional accommodations and supports, often mentoring through disability resources and services. Those are currently located at Central Lakes College in Brainerd and Ridgewater College in Willmar. There's also the Occupational Skills program, which is also at Ridgewater College in Willmar, and that's a mixed or hybrid program where students take a set of core classes focused on developing those transition skills and then have access to additional college courses. Minnesota Life College, located in Richfield, is a substantially separate program. They specialize in providing supports for students with autism spectrum disorder. Their motto is Real Skills for Real Life. They don't have college as part of their program, but what they do is they work with a lot of the local community colleges and get students who are interested in that as part of their learning experience connected to take classes as part of their program. Another program is Beyond Limits, part of Bethany Missions College down in Bloomington. That's a mixed or hybrid program. It's a two-year program. Students live in the apartments that are located on the campus just like any other student, and they are working all towards different fields in ministry or missionary work. And then the BUILD program, which is what we're here to tell you more about, is the newest of these options. We are a mixed or hybrid program, meaning that we have a core set of transition classes that students take, But then, like I said, you see two ladies before you who are taking other classes because of what they're interested in. Here is a picture of our students on the very first day of class. I love to look back at this. I don't know if you can see it right now, but even the two young women who are sitting here before you look a little bit nervous. They have smiles, but they're not quite sure what they're getting into. It has been amazing to see their development already in these first 6 months that we've had. So they now walk onto campus with confidence that they know their way around. That was one thing they were both concerned about at first. And they really feel that they belong. And you'll get an opportunity to hear from them about what that means to them. So like I said, this is a two-year post-secondary program for students with intellectual disabilities. We are actually the first program in Minnesota at a four-year university. Students are currently in their spring semester. And one thing that we really feel is important about our program is that inclusive residential component. For a lot of our students, this is the first time that they've really been away from home for more than a week and been able to really push the limits of what they even thought that they could do on their own. Excuse me, I won't share that with you. Being a mixed or hybrid program means that we have a core curriculum focused on those transition skills. The classes that students take related to this are independent living, job skills, social skills, money management, and then some other favorites are physical fitness and Bible classes. Students are provided with an opportunity to also take elective courses. And this is set up very similar to auditing, so that students get to pick what class they want to be part of. They get full access to the class, and the main focus is participating and learning things that they are interested in. For some students, they're interested in things that are related to their career goals. For other students, they want to have fun and take a college course in something that they've never even heard of or known how to spell. We've had a lot of fun learning how to spell badminton this year, right? And how we're doing this is students are working with faculty who have been trained in universal design for learning. We talked earlier about the Americans with Disability Act. That's what provided universal design. It's access for people with disabilities. Universal design for learning applies those same principles to learning so that you're putting assistive technology in place or accommodating things by presenting in multiple formats up front. We do this typically for students by using iPads so that all of the accessibility features are built in. Students have all of their textbooks loaded on their iPad so that it can be read out loud to them, so there aren't those additional barriers to learning or accessing the content of the course. Another really great thing about our program is students participate in internships that are matched to the areas of employment interest, and they do this both on campus for the first year and off campus for the second year. For a lot of our students, they are so excited to have an opportunity to do something that they've always thought would be neat for a job. And a lot of transition programs to local school districts have different sheltered work experiences, which is great because it gives students a lot of broad experiences, but they go as a group to different sites and do these work experiences, not because they're interested in it, but it's because that's where the group is going. And so it really is empowering for students to, again, have that choice in what they're doing and where they're working, and then also to build their skills to be able to list on their resume that they have had real work experience in doing the jobs that they are interested in pursuing. In order to do this, we also provide, oh, thank you so much. In order to do this, students currently receive support from four different mentors, and excuse me. So the types of mentors that we have are housing mentors, job mentors, student mentors, and social mentors. We currently have 32 students, Bethel University students, who are hired as mentors to support our 12 students in the program. Housing mentors live alongside students. They help with the development of the independent living skills. That's the cooking, that's the laundry, that's the personal care. It's also getting connected to the community of students that they're living with. We also have job mentors who work alongside of students. You can see right here, we have two young women working in the dining center. This is the young woman who wanted some experience cooking or working in a restaurant. Her speed in completing these tasks is something that would be very difficult for her to do where somebody ordered something and she'd have to hurry up and prepare it. So what she does is works in the dining center and prepares some of the Simply To Go items. So she works ahead of time to prepare the salads and the fruits and the veggies and stuff so it's all ready to go. and has fallen in love with this. This is what she wants to do for her career when she's done, and she's really excelled at it. She started with needing this young woman right by her side to be able to do this, and is now able to do the entire process by herself. So the job mentor is now there working on her separate pieces and being available if needed, so that when Abigail gets to a point that she doesn't know what to do next or gets stuck with a new skill, she's got somebody there to go to. But at the same time, she's demonstrating a lot of independence in this. Students also have support from student mentors. Student mentors help students not only with the academic workload that they are working through, college classes, and I think maybe these two young women will tell you that the academic demands increase in the second semester.
Yes.
There's more homework. So we've actually even added more sessions with the student mentors to be able to help students with completing that. But they also help them to go beyond that. So we're not just talking about the textbook learning, but also real skills for job development and life development. Rita is actually about to begin a first aid and CPR certification course because she wants to work with young children, and that's a job requirement for most positions in a daycare. So she's already passed it once before, despite somebody telling her that she couldn't, and so she's excited to again prove them wrong and show that she can do it, right? Yeah. And lastly, we have social mentors. These are students who actually are volunteers working with students to help them get connected on campus. We did not want students to just be connected to the students that they were living with or going to classes with, and so this has been helpful for students to get connected to a different group of friends and to have somebody to go to different events with. When students complete the program, they received an applied study certificate with a focus in either health or human services, business for information technology, education, ministry, or arts. All of our students in the first cohort are from Minnesota. We have 8 female students and 4 male students. All of them had received special education services throughout their education for developmental cognitive disabilities, other health disabilities, or autism spectrum disorder. For this next year, we've seen that there's even more interest in this program. We had 3 students remain on a waiting list from the first year. We weren't able to get them in. We didn't have enough spots. So for the remaining 9 spots, we had 38 applications. We did accept another set of 12 students and 2 students, actually 3 students, onto the waiting list. Of that group, we have 2 women and 10 men. The first year, the men were a little late to apply, and then now that has completely changed. They've heard about this program and are excited to be part of it. In this next group, we have 8 students from Minnesota, so still very Minnesota dominant. We also do have students coming from Wisconsin and Iowa. The total cost for our program matches the cost of typical college expenses at Bethel. What we have done, though, is we have built into that the annual cost for all of the core courses, all of the elective courses, the supports, those are the mentors that we had talked about, the books, the instructional materials, the room, the meal plan, and the activity fee. We want it to be all-encompassing so that students get the full college experience. To help families in paying for this, we have developed a lot of funding partnerships already. The direct cost of families and students can really be directly lessened through these partnerships. We have a partnership with Vocational Rehabilitation Services. We have a counselor who comes to campus once a month to meet with students, to talk about how things are going with their internships, to talk about planning ahead for employment when they finish the program. And then that also is a funding source for families where they are paying for the internship and for the job mentor fee for families who meet those guidelines. We do also have partnerships with several counties throughout the state. Medicaid waivers, which are also known as developmental delay, DD, or community alternatives for disabled individuals, CADI waivers. Both of those options fall under the CDCS option, which stands for consumer-directed community supports. What this is this is Medicaid funding because students have significant disabilities and need support. What this allows them to do is use that funding for courses that match those same goals that they have on their community support plan for something that's truly inclusive and that matches what any other student their age is doing, going to college. We also do have scholarships. Our students have had great success in accessing some national scholarships. We also provide scholarships. Any money that's donated to build is turned around and directly used to fund student scholarships. We've already awarded $40,000 in scholarships to students, so we're doing what we can to help meet that need as well. And then we are applying to become a comprehensive transition program. What that will do is enable us to have a certification that would allow families to apply for Pell Grants through federal financial aid. Despite these partnerships, there is still a financial gap that would be helped in part by the Minnesota State Grant. The president of our university could not be here with us today, but he does have a quote that he has shared about the BUILD program, and I really think it encompasses why we have this program. He says that BUILD is valuable because it offers post-secondary education to a group of students who didn't previously have access, and because it invites additional diversity into our community. We're committed to serving students with intellectual disabilities, helping them to take their place as independent, productive, and valued members of our community and of our world. Oh, my video got cut out. So I always think that it's helpful to hear from the people who are in charge, like the president, but I also had a video that I was going to share with you from a student when he got his acceptance package in the mail, just like any other student. And what it is he gets it, and he's very excited, and he's not saying anything. So his mom says, "What is it?" And his answer is acceptance. And I just hit the microphone, so I don't know if you heard that, but his answer was acceptance. And his mom says, "From where?" "Bethel University." So that's really what this program is about for us, acceptance of all students. And we are really, really proud to be able to share this with you, and we hope that you see that there is a need. It was really heartbreaking to have to say no to so many students, because I really truly believe that there are so many students who would benefit from this type of program, and there just currently are not enough opportunities. So I do want to give you an opportunity to hear from these two young women about what the BUILD program means to them, and then I would love to answer any questions that you may have as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I don't know which student's going to go first, but neither one of them looked very nervous. And they've been waiting patiently. So would you tell us your name and then tell us your story, okay?
My name is Rita, and I'm from Maplewood. I live at Maplewood, and I went to BUILD program and above BUILD program. BUILD program is a great place to be. People at school are really great and nice to others, and they are also awesome to be around with and to hang out with. The teachers at BUILD program are great. They are nice to the kids and teaches us so much things like math, independent home living, and many more classes too. I really love and enjoy the BUILD program. It's really a great place to be. And I also like my internship.
What are you doing at the internship?
I work with kids.
Ah.
Like preschoolers.
Okay. Very good. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Now,
okay.
You want a slide? There you are.
Okay, I'm Monica Hovey, and I live in Eden Prairie. I was originally from Russia, and I don't know, my favorite thing about the BUILD program is probably just being at Bethel and getting that whole college experience, and just, I don't know, honestly, everything. It's so hard for me to narrow it down, but, you know, I will sometime get there. But I don't know, just everybody I've met, everybody who's come to my life, they just have been such a blessing, especially these two right here. I'm so thankful I get to be with them out of school, even on spring break, and I don't know, just all the teachers, and having Dawn as my advisor, just all the teachers are just so amazing. And I don't know.
Did you say you're from Russia?
Yeah, I was originally adopted. Yeah, I was from. I was adopted from Russia when I was 6 months old. So.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
You speak good English.
Yes. Well, I was 6 months old. I remember anything. So there's that part of that.
Yeah. Yeah. You could be Norwegian.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Well, that's great. You had to have a lot of patience to spend this much time here, too, waiting for your opportunity. Yeah. Oh, I was just whispered in my ear, you're on the dance team?
Yes, I'm on the dance team. I forgot to mention that. I'm on the dance team. It has been such a dream come true. The season just ended, so I'm somewhat sad, but somewhat so happy that I've gotten that opportunity to finally be on a dance team. Because when I was in high school, I tried for that, like my high school's dance team, I didn't get in, which is totally fine. It was totally intimidating anyways, but you know. But you know, there's like that part of it. But then really get on Bethel's dance team, it's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that this is even possible. Like, I never thought that this would even be like a thing that would happen in my life. So
what, tell me about the dance team. Is this competition, or do it for...
It's actually both. We had one competition, then we like mostly perform at like halftime shows at like football games and one basketball game.
Great.
And during homecoming. So
wonderful.
Yeah.
And you had to try out for that?
Yes, I did. Yeah, it was really scary, but I got through it.
Yeah. Yeah, most of us wouldn't make it. In fact, all of us wouldn't make it. Yeah. Well, anything more? We have a bill here that's probably going to be very positive, moving this into maybe the next realm of the Minnesota State University system. So maybe, unless you have any final comments?
Just if there's any questions, but I'm glad you asked about the dance team. It's been really exciting to see students, again, have the choice in what they get involved in. So you've had students...
It is, yeah.
We had students be part of, you saw one young man who worked with the hockey team. Your students are now getting involved with the softball team. And what else? Just lots of fun things. Swim team,
yeah.
Swim club.
I don't know. But
I get confused about teams and clubs, so Annika gives me a hard time, especially because I always call it dance line, and it's dance team, so you got it right. Good job.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I forgot to ask if there are questions, and new Representative Leon has one, I guess.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious if any of the students plan to go on for further education.
We do have a couple students, now that they've gotten comfortable with the workload and being back in school, who've asked about whether or not that would be an opportunity. So all of our students are earning credit for the classes that they're taking. They're all at the developmental level. So it would be a possibility for somebody to go on afterwards, and we would have to just plan for that individually for what kind of supports they would need and what they would be focused on. But it has been exciting, like I said, before we got started, while we were waiting, I think it was Annika and both Rita sharing that they are doing so much more now than they ever even thought was possible. And so I think that the more that we do this, or the more opportunities that students get and see that they can handle it, exactly, the more that they're willing to try. And we have one young woman who is in a class that half of it is lecture and half of it's theater. She's loving it. She's doing what she can to take notes and being part of it and just thinking it's a great challenge and wants to go on from there. Yeah.
Any others have questions? If not, I thank you very much for your presentation. It's been very good. And you can watch as Representative Daniels now presents his bill. Members, we started late, so we may run just a little late. Not as late as yesterday, but and maybe we won't have to, depending on how long Mr. Daniels takes here. So not that you have to rush.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
First, we need to move. You want to move your bill, House File, what is it? 2896.
Yep, I move a House File 2896.
And this would be held over for possible inclusion in our
correct
omnibus bill.
Yep.
Okay. You want to proceed, Representative Daniels?
You bet. Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, committee, for hearing this. The gals, they couldn't have done a better job. I thank to Don Allen there for the presentation and Rita for and Annika for their testimony. It was really, really good to hear. Let me get down to this. We can get out of here. Chair Nornis and members of the Higher Education Committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to present House File 2896. I also want to thank the folks from Bethel University for being here and giving such a great presentation. It's so wonderful to see Minnesota Higher Education institutions leading the way to give more opportunities to young adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I'm a proud author on this bill because it expands the type of program we just heard about to our Minsky campuses. I'm sure we all have family or friends that have intellectual or developmental disabilities. I'm a little tired from last night. Sorry, Chair.
Yeah, it's understandable.
My oldest nephew actually has autism, and he's... this program would have been around when he was probably in his late teens, early 20s, I think there would have been a huge, huge difference in how he spent. He's close to 40 now. I'm just excited that this is an opportunity for the younger kids, and get a chance to do that. So very, very pleased with that. This bill establishes a pilot program that would provide an inclusive two-year full-time residential college experience for participants and would lead to an appropriate academic credential upon completion. The bill also extends eligibility for state financial aid programs to participate or for participants for students with intellectual or developmental disabilities enrolled in the Minsku pilot program, as well as to participants in similar programs at our other post-secondary institutions in Minnesota. The program will be offered at four state university campuses beginning in the year 2017 and 18. Minsku has the flexibility to choose the four campuses for this program based on their ability to offer the robust program utilizing the existing facilities and resources, and with the goal to provide a program in diverse geographic regions of the state. In designing the pilot program, the Board of Trustees will consult with the Minnesota State Council on Disability, the Minnesota Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, ARC Minnesota, and other interested stakeholders. Our legislative staff is putting together a working group with stakeholder groups, including those listed, as well as including the private college council, folks from the University of Minnesota, so we can all work together to create a best possible program and experience for these students. The pilot program will have at least 10 incoming students per academic year, and the students will be admitted based on application process that includes a in-person interview, independent assessment of applicants' interest, motivation, and likelihood of success in the program, and any other eligibility requirements established by the board. Upon successful completion, a student must be awarded a certificate, diploma, or other appropriate academic credential. We want to ensure that the students are entering an academic setting where they can be successful. The required curriculum will include core courses that develop life skills, financial literacy, the ability to live independently, rigorous academic work in students' chosen field of study, an internship, apprenticeship, or other skills based on experience to prepare for meaningful employment upon completion of the program. In addition, the academic requirements of the program will offer participating students the opportunity to engage fully in campus life. Program activities would include, but are not limited to, the establishment of on-campus mentors and peer support communities and opportunities for personal growth through leadership development and other community engagement activities. A participating campus may tailor the program and curriculum and activities to highlight academic programs, students, and community life experiences. Sorry for that.
That's okay. How did we fix it before? What? What?
There.
Wow. Wow.
Sorry about that.
Don't move.
That's one thing I didn't expect. I'm sorry about that, Chair.
Yeah. It would have cut your testimony short there because we couldn't hear a word. So.
Oh, yeah. We're almost out of time.
I don't have to hurry. We're
okay. Oh, yeah, I was just saying it was the participating campus may tailor the program to curriculum and activities to highlight academic programs, students, and community life experiences and employment opportunities unique to that campus or the region of the state where the campus is located. Progress reports, the Minsku board would submit progress reports on the pilot program required by this section to the chairs and ranking minority members of the committees of the legislature with jurisdiction over higher education finance and policy and human services finance and policy. Students with intellectual and developmental disabilities need more options when they finish high school, and I look forward to working with the stakeholders to plan the best possible program for these students. It is time that we stop putting students with disabilities in a box, and we start and we can accomplish what they can be and we think we can, they can accomplish what they can be expected from them. It is time that we are creative and think outside the box and give these students the tools and support they need to surpass expectations and create the kind of life that they want for themselves. With that, I thank you for that and open to any
questions. Ready for questions? Couple of quick ones, I guess. How did we select 4 as the magic number for this pilot? Is there a reason necessarily for that number?
I think it was 4, just kind of a random number just to start with.
Okay.
Just so we didn't go too...
Yeah, I don't have a feeling one way or the other.
Right.
I'm just thinking of some of the resistance we might run into that, you know, where they may want us to start a little smaller and slower. And then the other question is 4-year versus 2-year. Is that because of housing and those kinds of things that may not be available at most 2-year schools?
Right. To get the full experience, I think the 2-year colleges that have on-living campuses would be, nice to have. I think that's part of the experience that the girls are excited about. They're roommates. They have a good time. And when they get into the regular classes, they really enjoy with the other students. So,
sure.
Yeah, I think it's getting that full campus experience. And
right. Representative Thiel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I really just have a comment. I want to thank Representative Daniels for bringing this bill. Just really, really excited about this. I was not aware until just recently that this program was even there. I want to thank the students and Bethel for the fantastic, inspiring job that you did in presenting to us. And I see when I was listening to your presentation that the bill is not prescriptive on what this program is going to look like, that it'll be up to each of the the entities that MNSCU decides as to what this program is going to look like. But after having listened to the presentation and about the various mentors, the housing, the social, the job, the student, the program, this works, I think, because it's so comprehensive. And so I would just offer strong encouragement to the four entities that are selected to consider embracing this template, because it's so comprehensive, and I think it will make a big difference.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions from members? Representative Lehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment, and Representative Daniels, I appreciate you bringing this forward. This is obviously we've heard it's a successful program for students and, a good bill. I guess I would just add that I think it would be in the program's interest in some of the reporting requirements if we could see things like job placement rates for students that have gone through this. If students are indeed going on for further education, I think that would be good for us to see. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Daniels,
I certainly think that that's a very good idea to have a path of where they started from and where they're going to. And I think there's other states have done this before, and I'm not sure the numbers or percentage, but there's quite a few that are going on to full-time working positions. So
it may be early in the process to have some of that information available, but it's a good point. Anybody else? If not, we'd like to vote on House File 2896. Oh, he's laid over. I'm sorry. A little premature, a little excited here. I want to pass a bill here sometime.
Tell.
Okay. Then, yeah. Okay. Yeah, Representative Daniels, do you want to renew your motion then?
Yes, I move that Bill number 20, help with the number.
2896.
96, be laid over for inclusion.
Okay, thank you very much. All right. Thank you for that. And we have a little time for Minsky to respond if there's someone here or someone else in the audience who would like to. Just don't upset the table. I mean, not don't turn it, but whatever makes it go noise crazy, just don't do that.
All we have is paper. So
okay.
I think
all right. You'll be fine. Just fine. All right. Who wants to start?
Hello, my name is Wendy Robinson, and I'm the Director of Student Services for the Minnesota State College and University System. And I just want to thank you, Chairman, and thank the committee for the opportunity to talk with you today and share a little bit about how Minsky already serves students with intellectual, physical learning, and psychological disabilities at all of our campuses. Minsky is an institution that values access and diversity, and as part of that diversity, it includes students with disabilities. We currently serve close to 10,000 students across the system who have self-identified as having either a physical, learning, psychological, or other disability, and who have requested to work with our Disability Services Office to receive the accommodations afforded to them under the Americans with Disabilities Act. As was mentioned by the fine folks from Bethel, who were excited to learn more about your program as well, we have in the past had two TIPSC programs at Ridgewater College and Central Lakes College. Unfortunately, those colleges, those programs will be discontinued at the end of the spring because the grant funding that funded those programs was not continued into the future. So that is one area where we have been able to provide service but are not able to do that any longer. Our institutions are committed to providing appropriate accommodations to the nearly 10,000 students that we serve, and those include not only the academic accommodations necessary to help those students be successful in class, but also making sure that our campuses are warm and welcoming environments for all of our students. We look forward to making sure that our students have the opportunities to have full participation in the college experience, whether that's study abroad, whether that's participating in campus life activities, whether that's doing internships, or even service learning, things like that. I'd like to have, we have offices of students with disabilities at all of our campuses, and I also have two gentlemen who serve in two of those, serve as directors of those centers at their campuses. Beyond our disability services offices, we also have opportunities for students to participate in student support services, which is a federally funded TRIO program that offers support services to students with disabilities at over 20 of our campuses, as well as a whole range of other supportive programs like academic tutoring, advising, counseling services at all of our campuses. In order to help the committee have the context to understand what we're already doing at our Minsky campuses, I thought it would be helpful to have Caden Riley and Tom Lynch tell you a little bit about what who we're serving and how we're serving them at our campuses. So I'll turn it over to Caden or Tom first.
Okay. Identify yourself for the record, please, so we can hear what
yes,
your name
my
is.
Name is Tom Lynch, and I'm currently the Director of Access Services at North Hennepin Community College. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, for allowing us to speak today. I'm currently in my third year at North Hennepin Community College as the Disability Coordinator. Prior to that, I worked for many years with Intermediate District 287 as a special educator, and so I have that K-12 background as well. A little bit more about myself. Currently, I have the honor of serving on the board of the Minnesota Association of Higher Education and Disability as the president-elect. This is our state professional organization of disability coordinators and basically disability coordinators from private, public, colleges across the state, and we meet on a regular basis. I just like to give you a quick overview of what our office does. Basically, as the disability coordinator for North Hennepin Community College, my role is to make sure that our campus and coursework is accessible to students with disabilities by providing reasonable accommodations. Basically, what we're doing is we're leveling the playing field for students with disabilities who qualify to be at North Hennepin by making sure that they have the appropriate accommodations so that they have equal access to all college programming and to their education. students have to actively choose to come and seek us out. They have to self-identify. We do our best to try to reach out to our students on a regular basis to make sure that they know that our office is on campus, and we can certainly talk more about that, but I want to be mindful of time. Currently, our office is serving, we have 339 students who are registered with our office. During this current semester, 202 of them have actively chosen to take advantage of their accommodations. And I just want to give you just a quick view of the types of students that we're, the types of disabilities that students we work with, you know, represent. Basically, 26% of our students that are working with the disability office have learning disabilities. 22% have attention deficit hyperactive disorder or attention deficit disorder. 6% have autism. 28%, that's the highest number, have psychiatric conditions, and as you can imagine, that includes individuals with who have been diagnosed with depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorder, so wide range of mental health impairments. 4% of our students have been diagnosed with traumatic brain injury. We have 1% of our students have been identified with intellectual disabilities. We do also serve, but don't currently have, students who are in recovery from chemical dependency, speech impairment. 1% of our population is deaf and so requires sign language interpretation. Hearing impairment, 2%. Mobility impairments, 2%. Systemic and otherwise whole body kinds of issues would be 16%. Limited vision, 4%. And we don't currently serve any students who are blind. Basically, once the students have presented us documentation of their disability, we sit down with them and we work very closely with them to try to come up with a reasonable set of accommodations. And so I'd just like to go very quickly through a list of kind of the more common accommodations that we provide for students. Many of our students benefit from getting note-taking assistance. They also benefit from alternate text formats, in other words, textbooks in audio format or maybe visually enhanced textbooks, extended testing time, being allowed to test in a quieter location, audio versions of their tests. Sometimes they can hear the test and read it at the same time. That really helps them to process. Assistive technology, you know, audio equipment to allow a student to hear the instructor in class provide a lecture. We mic the instructor, the student has a receiver unit. We have also visual enhancement technology. Adaptive software that provides help for our students with vision needs. Screen reading programs are very popular, not only with the students with disabilities, but now they are becoming very popular across campus, and that's a wonderful example of universal design where something developed for students with disabilities is becoming a benefit for all. Sign language interpreters and then captioning services. But as Wendy alluded to, I think a major role and kind of the buck stops at our office is to make sure that our students are connecting. We really take pride in this at North Hennepin, making sure our students are connecting with the tutoring services, making sure our students are connecting with the TRIO program, making sure they're connecting with their advisors, making sure they're connecting with faculty. It can be really intimidating to go and try to problem solve with a faculty person. So we will go with the students and help that. Developing our students' ability to advocate for themselves in a post-secondary setting, we would like them, if it's their desire, to be able to leave North Hennepin after 2 years and function much more independently at a four-year institution.
I just want to mention, we'd like to wrap up here in about five minutes.
Yes, and I'm finished with my comments.
Okay. I didn't want to cut you off, but...
No, I appreciate your patience.
You've got somebody else there that's anxious to speak. And identify yourself, too, and then go ahead and testify.
Yes, my name is Caden Riley, and I'm the Director of Disability Services at MCTC over in Minneapolis. And in the interest of time, I'll be very brief for you. I also serve on the board at Minutehead, the Minnesota. Wow, I just forgot the acronym. What is that? Association of Higher Education and Disabilities. And my role as that third year on the board is I'm the affiliate member, which means that I am the connection between Minutehead, the local regional, to AHEAD, which is the national board for that. And one of the reasons I've been asked to come and talk today is the fact that not only is what Tom is saying accurate on campuses, I recognize that I have the same issues on my own campus and the same challenges and the same successes in a lot of the ways, but we're also having this specific conversation on a national level with a lot of other DS people across the nation, mostly at research institutions that are looking at programs like the Build, which I've been working with Don off and on through MedHead for a while now, and what they're doing is great work, but it is just one example of many different programs out there, and what we're seeing is it needs to look differently depending on the institution, and so one size doesn't fit all because it doesn't fit all for our students, and so looking at how we can really engage in that conversation and continue with that conversation has been an interesting experience for me all year long with these people across the nation.
And I would just say, as this the discussion about this bill moves forward, I think Minsky is uniquely positioned to both bring in the expertise about what we're currently doing, but also because we are so connected with the national conversation, to be able to make sure that we're looking at what are the best practices across the country, what are the best ways that we can serve all of Minnesota students, and especially those who have intellectual disabilities as well. So we're appreciative of the opportunity to have had time with you today and look forward to continued conversations about this in the future. And, of course, we're open to any questions that anybody might have.
All right, thank you. We thank you for everything you're doing already, and we do look forward to the interaction between Minsky and this bill and this committee. So, good. Appreciate that. Any questions? If not, we're right on time. So, this meeting is adjourned.